way that landlords are have a role in this. I think that oftentimes people these conversations about gentrification, like I said before, if you guys holding skinny bikes or skinny bikes, and it just talks more about the housing crisis that we have and how this is fueled by the profiteering that can go on between big developers and landlords and all of this, and how there is, as actually Janelle Pony, who's on our list, has described, a black tax. It's so much harder to find places to live. You're showing fewer apartments and homes if you're black, and I think this adds another layer to that phenomenon. Tracy, what do we have lined up for the rest of the episode? Well, Ian Millhiser comes back once again to do another SCOTUS roundup. We're going to talk to him about all the cases that are on the docket. Some of them really should not be.
Attack on unions, certainly the most serious attack on the core. agency fees for those folks, and that's just to reimburse them for the cost of, you know, hiring the lawyers and doing all the stuff you have to do to collectively bargain. The problem is if unions are not allowed to charge these fees, is that all of a sudden you get all the benefits of being in a union, but you don't necessarily have to pay a thing. So people quit the union because they're getting all the benefits, whether they're in it or not, and then eventually the union doesn't have enough money to perform its basic functions, and the union collapses, and then no one gets any of the benefits.
So essentially, it creates a short-term free riding problem and then a long-term destruction of the union.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's about. I mean, this is the same thing. You know, you're sometimes hear the term right-to-work laws is one of the most misnamed terms you'll ever hear. Is exactly what I just described. It is a law that says that union is not allowed to charge these agency fees, so non-members can get all the benefits of being in the union without actually having to, you know, to pay anything in return. I should note that union fees generally are a tiny fraction of the benefits of being in a union. You know, the average unionized worker earns, I believe, it's about 12% more than similarly situated non-unionized worker. I am actually in a union. My union dues are a percentage and a half of my wages. So, you know, rather, if I had paid agency fees, I'm a member, but if I paid agency fees, they would be the same amount. So, generally speaking, you get a whole lot more for being in a union than you pay in the agency fees. These fees are just there to make the union viable. And if you take those away, whether through the so-called right to work laws or through this Friedrichs case, that's seeking to essentially impose a right-to-work regime on every public sector union in the country, then you're eventually going to gut many of these unions' ability to function because it's going to be very hard for them to have enough money to operate.
So while this is, it's largely being disguised as kind of a freedom of speech battle, I've seen that workers should be able to, you know, spend their money how they see fit if they don't want to participate in a union. But really what's at the heart of it is that people are going to get worse wages as a result, and there's just a long-term benefit that are really startling. And the thing that gave me the most pause when I was researching this was it's largely funded by the Koch brothers. But I feel like as when you see that, that's your huge red flag. This is probably something not good.
Yeah, but this particular case isn't brought by this group, but there were two predecessor cases that laid much of the groundwork for it that were brought by the National Right to Work Legal Committee, which is probably the leading anti-union litigation shop out there. This one's being argued by this lawyer, Michael Carvin, who last time on Buffy the Vampire Slayer was seen trying to kill the Affordable Care Act. It's a troubling case. They have a really creative legal theory. I mean, you alluded to it, it's a free speech type case.
It's creative. It's also, it's sort of intuitively appealing. Right. I mean, that's part of what's so suave about it.
Yep.
If you don't actually know much about this, but you hear just the thumbnail sketch and someone says, no, that's a violation of free speech, I think a lot of people might sort of instinctively go, oh man, that's a terrible thing. People should be free to do what they want to do.
Yeah. So the theory behind it is that unions engage in a conversation with employers. I mean, what unions do is they sit down and they bargain with the employer, and that requires speech. And so the theory is that if you object to what the union is doing, you shouldn't be required to pay these agency fees that then fund speech that you might disagree with. So that's the idea behind it as a free speech case. The problem with that is that if you take that view seriously, I don't see how you can have any regulation of the workplace. When I was hired at CAP, I sat down with the woman who was then our de facto HR director, and we had a conversation, and she said, like, we would like to pay you this much money, and I came back with a certain another number, and we someone too little if they qualify for the minimum wage. person dealing with government benefits or dealing with employer benefits, and they can't offer any benefits that are illegal under that law. So you can characterize all of those as restrictions on speech. But if all of a sudden that means they're unconstitutional under the First Amendment, that means we really can't have any kind of regulation of the workplace at all. And America becomes a pretty nasty place pretty quickly.
Is that what this case is about? Is this using collective bargaining as sort of the first chip away at any level of regulations or constraints on business?
It's a good question. I mean, anti-union groups have wanted to chip away at these agencies for a really long time. And there's a case called Abood, I believe, from the 1980s, where they challenged, it was basically the same case, where they brought a challenge to these agencies, and they lost. And now we have a much more conservative Supreme Court, and they think they can win this time around. And unfortunately, there's a good likelihood they will win, given the court that we have. This attack on unions has been around for a while. Now, that said, there are certainly elements within the highest levels of the legal profession. There's a gentleman appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court today who thinks that most of our labor laws, including minimum wage laws, the maximum hour laws, the laws protecting the right to organize, are unconstitutional. So there are people at very high levels who want to go there. Most of them don't want to go through the First Amendment, but I'm sure if they got that, they'd be happy to take it.
When given a lot of the political opposition to, even having a freaking minimum wage, right, which like serious political candidates for, president on one side of the aisle actually seriously, right? I mean, maybe that's not crazy to contemplate. I know we have a lot more cases we want to talk through, but thank you for that with Friedrichs, because I personally now understand this a little lot more. So there's another case that we would love to sort of have you help us understand, and that's the Cole case coming out of Texas. What's that one about?
Yeah, I mean, this could really be the term of the universe, because there are just two huge reproductive justice cases. Potentially, I don't think the court is likely to write the words, therefore Roe v. Wade is overruled in their opinion. But if Texas wins, if their law is upheld, and then the abortion clinic loses, then it could have the same practical effect as if Roe v. Wade were overruled. So the idea behind this law in Cole is it is two provisions of Texas's anti-abortion law that are challenged. The first deals with what we're calling admitting privileges. So if you're a physician who performs abortion in Texas, you have to have the right to sign patients to admit patients into a hospital that is sufficiently nearby, I believe it's within 30 miles or something like that. And the second is that it's called an ambulatory surgical center requirement. What that translates as, for the most part, is that if you want to operate an abortion clinic, you have to have to comply with very extensive architectural rules. And those rules normally apply to places that perform, often there are major surgeries. The problem with both of these laws is if you look at them on their face, they look like they're health laws. So there's some intuitive sense to, okay, well, I want a doctor who can check me into this hospital in case I need to, and abortion, it sounds like a surgery, and so, we want to have a performance facility that's built for that. When you dig down really just below the surface, it becomes clear that they're shams. So, just anyone who's ever been to the emergency room, because you don't need to have a previous relationship with the doctor who has the many privileges at that hospital in order to get administered and get into the
Sure. About specifically the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you.
insurance at all, but you pay someone money, they can take that money and go to the pharmacy and pop birth and verify how they're going to buy something else.
That's what you're saying to
workers.
Right? I mean, that's not right here. But the idea is that
you know, how much is it
when I call that one, right?
I mean, I'll pay the next week's bill for a couple more minutes at minimum wage.
Well, yes.
I don't know if it's going to be the same thing as you need.
Well, I mean, right. So, for now. Next year, we bring it back to this again. We'll have another case. So, nothing like them seconds that we have left with you again.
Still accountability where someone engages in suit. The company can get out of it by buying off the, like, the way that these things work procedurally is normally there's one thing or a small group of people who bring the suit, and then later on it's certified that all these other people get brought in as a class. And so the idea here is you just buy off that one person with the $30 that they claim they're owed. You're at the company's out $30, the suit's over. And it never becomes a class action, so there's never any real accountability, even if there's $30 million worth of legality that went on. So, you know, that's a really scary case, I think, for consumers, because, you know, you do have these situations where companies will decide, hey, we can get away with this if we just spread it out and think about our profits that way. And this will, you know, make it very difficult for those companies to be held accountable.
Justice Center for Think Progress and author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Thanks for joining us. Are we impressing 2 for 2, Tracy?
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back. It is the first Weekly Worst of 2016. I am. First time I've said the year right since 2016 started. In studio with us, we have Alan Pike, our dear friend, and one of our favorite reporters ever, but also from Think Progress. Tracy, to start the year off right. Mostly for my benefit, how we can work. Yes. Yes, to me. Or so. Or more. Thank you.
hours on nights where they would be resting for 3 or 6 late at night. What Cuomo's doing is sort of like a mean cousin of that, like evil twin of this. That's what you call my colleague, Chris Colbert, but I did some reporting on this. And in the process, looked at Maria Fosterkinis, sorry, Maria, if I butchered that, the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, who pointed out, quote, these are not the people need to be forced to accept help. The problem is that help is not available.
So it's a mandate by particularly health ministers. It's an unfunded mandate.
Sources to the folks that Bryce was talking to for this story. It's one of the things that should create a major incentive for the city to invest in permanent housing options for folks and to really take a serious and lasting bite out of homelessness in the city. And instead, because it's much more lucrative for everybody involved to build a high rise luxury condo building, the way that the rent shelter requirement ends up actually playing out. Is the city ends up renting motel rooms on a short-term basis and going to court to try to get them to loosen the details of the rules of the right to shelter law so that they don't have to give every family a private indoor space for the night. They can put multiple families into these old, these aging structures that they would like to stop using as shelter space because of how old they've gotten and how the disrepair that they've fallen into. Again, the basic market dynamics of the real estate development world in a city like D.C. that is relatively prosperous, but massively unequally distributed, you end up instead of incentivizing the kinds of permanent housing options that we know reduce homelessness in a lasting way, in a meaningful way, you end up kind of flailing ad hoc when the temperatures drop. And that's the mess.
I know we do want to ask for, because I was only number two, and we've gotten, often a tangent, because you know how to pick on that. Attention service providers or shelters that are so important, but we need more shelter beds, not fewer. But there are negative experiences that some people have in well-intentioned homeless shelter situations where they end up being abused, they end up being beaten up, particularly people with mental illness, particularly women. And that's the thing that we need to recognize and respect is that people experiencing homelessness can have very valid reasons for that. Thank you. educating their children. And this story is actually making me really sad. And this my vote will be the worst.
Of course, these are the same poor kids who are slowly being led by this entire glass of water. And our parents can't afford to buy the bottled water as an alternative to
the grocery store in the front or something.
Oh, is that different?
Sure. Sense to sort of be lavish in your civic planning, and a lot of what probably needs to happen for these longer term structural financial issues in Detroit and the area surrounding it to get on a sustainable path and not just sort of bounce from crisis to crisis like we're seeing with this public school story, is a pretty radical and major physical restructuring of the physical infrastructure of these cities. And they have to contract so that they are appropriately organized and sized for the current population that lives there, and that will put them in a position to potentially expand in the future. But, you know, I kind of, in that sense, you gotta kind of get it better.
Absolutely. And a planned shrinkage, as urban planners discussed, and it's hard to execute it because, as a term,
and that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also find us on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. East, 8 a.m. West on the Progressive Voices Network using the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes, and don't forget to leave us a rating. Feel free to pitch us on Twitter via the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org.
See you next week.